Hello, and welcome to the podcast series of the Warwick Commission on the Future of Cultural Value. This series will present conversations on the Commission's many talking points and on the current debates in the cultural world with arts professionals, academics and specialists, as well as with our commissioners themselves. And indeed, here with me today is one of the commissioners. In this first podcast, I'll be chatting to Nick Chater, Professor of Behavioural Science at Warwick Business School and an expert on the question of what value really means. I'd like to begin by asking, why is the question of cultural value so significant?
Well, I suppose the question of value for things that aren't traded of all kinds is very interesting. Environmental value, value of health, the things that are in markets and can be bought and sold have clear monetary values, but many of the things we care about most don't, and how does one then value them in economic terms? That's a crucial question. Of course, very central to the category of things that aren't traded, or at least to some extent aren't traded, but the things that are enormously important to us, is culture.
So, in light of its complex position within markets, is it actually possible, or indeed is it necessary, to give value to culture?
Well, I think there are sort of two angles on that. I mean, one is to say, well, of course you wouldn't want to imagine there's a single scale of value against which you can measure all cultural work. So you can say something facile, like Shakespeare's, sort of twice as important as Dickens, or three times, or try to measure symphonies against pop songs. Trying to have a single measure which would give you a sense of the aesthetic value, or indeed for that matter, the historical importance of a work, is an extraordinarily ambitious and probably wildly over-ambitious and impossible task. On the other hand, in practice, one of the roles value plays in society is determining how we act. So normally, we try to act so that we respect the values we care about most and put aside the values we care about least, and when we have limited resources, of course, we're always making trade-offs. So if you're thinking about government resources, for example, you've got the question of how much money you should take from the population and how you should distribute that money, and for example, to improve people's health or to improve their education or to make the environment better. And one of the things you might think about in that regard is trying to engender a richer culture. Similarly, of course, people's actual expenditure in the marketplace, a lot of it actually is oriented towards things which do have cultural significance. People do pay money to go to the theatre, they pay money for the opportunity to watch films and television and music and so on and so on. Now, that probably doesn't exhaust cultural value, but it embeds the question of cultural value very much in the more mainstream questions of economics, how people spend their money, and politics, how decisions are made about how to allocate resources. So I think, in a practical sense, we have to have some sorts of answers, even if they're provisional and rather rough, which give us a sense of, well, this aspect of culture we value more than that, and therefore it should be prioritised. We have to answer those questions, even if we don't have a scale.
What are some of the possible methods of assessing cultural value? In other words, of offering a kind of temporary scale to help us answer those very questions?
There are a number of different approaches, and I'll run through one or two of them. And one approach is widely used for all kinds of things that can't be traded. So the strategy here is to try and look at some expenditure we engage in and see how that changes depending on the mysterious non-traded goods' presence or absence. So to make that concrete, suppose you're trying to work out how much people dislike railway noise. You could look at the house price depression for houses that are very near railways versus similar houses which aren't. So you might try something similar with culture. For example, you might look at the difference in property prices for houses which are near to cultural centres versus far from cultural centres. That's going to be hard to disentangle from all the other aspects of city life that tend to go near cultural centres, but maybe not impossible in some cases. That's one sort of strategy. Another similar strategy of an economic nature is to try and think about the amount of resources that people are consuming in order to consume the mysterious non-economic quantity you're interested in. So if it's the case, for example, that people spend a great deal of time engaged in consuming culture, that time is time they're not working. So a simple story might be, well, people have got to decide how to allocate their resources. One of the things they can do is work. One of the things they can do is consume culture. Aha! If they're consuming this much culture, it must tell us something about the its value to them. And, of course, the more they value culture, the more cultural time they're going to spend versus exercise time or time with family versus times at randomly surfing the web or indeed working. So that's another sort of strategy. Another, there are many others, but another completely different sort of approach is to ask people just straight out about their valuations. For example, by saying how much would you be willing to pay to have or not have some particular cultural experience, or to have some cultural institution present or absent. So, for example, you could ask people how much they'd be willing to contribute to maintain the BBC, and this isn't a hypothetical question because, of course, we actually have a licence fee. But if you had a licence fee for other artistic or cultural institutions, would people be willing to pay for that licence fee? Now, can you trust the answer people give for questions like that? It's not very clear, because, of course, I might say, well, zero, because I don't believe in that whole model, or I might say a huge amount of money, but I wouldn't really be willing to pay it in practice, but I can say that to give the sense that I'm a huge value out of, say, opera, whatever it may be. And, of course, a natural riposte to excessive reliance on that kind of approach is, well, okay then, so if people are willing to pay vast amounts of money for something, why isn't someone providing it and making a lot of money out of doing so? So if I say I value opera hugely and I'm willing to pay vast amounts for the Royal Opera House to exist, then you might say, right, well, why don't they just, just put their ticket prices up or open up a donation scheme and the money will just flood in. So you can get a sort of market testing for that kind of approach. Is it really the case that people actually make decisions, value decisions, which sort of align with what they say in these sort of other hypothetical contexts? So that's a slightly... It's a very simple approach to use, but it's a bit difficult to tell how effective it is. Mind you, that you can argue that's true of all of these approaches. Another approach is to give people various scenarios. For example, you could have scenarios in which they have more or less opportunity to engage with cultural activities of one kind or another, versus or more or less money, more or less good or bad health outcomes, and you could get them to look at different possible lives, perhaps their life, perhaps the life of some other person, and to say which life they would prefer. You don't have to do it in terms of lives, you can do it in terms of evenings. Whereas, here are possible evenings you might spend, which would you prefer? Or it could be anything. So you take some unit, it has culture embedded in it, you give people choices between the different possibilities, different possible ways that unit, the evening, the life could go. And then you look at those choices and you figure out, if people made these choices, then culture must have this much value, or if this aspect of culture has this much value. You're trying to work out from their choices, or their hypothetical choices, what the implicit values must be. So these are all very sort of quantitative approaches. A completely different strategy is, in fact, there are two, I suppose, that are worth mentioning. A completely different strategy is to think about explicit judgments of what's better than what. So if we're interested in allocating money to theatres, say, one might think, well, we'd better give it to the good theatres or the theatres which are most innovative. But then we've got to have a sense of what is the best theatre or what's the most innovative theatre. And one strategy is just to get lots of theatre critics or people who work in theatres just to say, well, rate, put them on a scale, which is the best, which is the second best, and to aggregate those judgments. And of course, prizes work like this, roughly speaking, except that the group of people making the decision is very small. Roughly speaking, you just get a bunch of novelists or ex-novelists or people in the literary scene, and they read a lot of novels and they say, we think that's the best one. And that's the strategy. Now that, in practice, is a very widely used approach, and may not be actually a particularly crazy one. Another similar strategy, which is a bit more inclusive, is to think about the problem of being a matter of sort of wider, creating a wider cultural debate. So it may be the case that we shouldn't really be asking ourselves what is the objective value of this or that thing in our culture. It's more a case of if we open up a debate about how we're going to use resources, what goods of different kinds, including cultural goods, are out there, what conclusions are we going to come to? So it's rather than saying, I want to devise a measuring stick or a measuring instrument, and I'm going to go around pointing it at bits of culture and valuing them. Another strategy is to say, no, what you need to do is to create the appropriate opportunity for people to discuss spending money on culture or other things, and just to see what they come up with, and that's the best we can do. It's not as if there's an objective answer of about what cultural value is outside the deliberations of the people in the culture. So that might be creating, you know, little panels. It might be creating wider conversations. It might be just consulting the normal political process and saying that which we end up funding must be that which we implicitly value the most.
How might your discipline, that of behavioural science, and in particular your work on the dimensions of the mind, challenge these methods of measurement?
The question of how much conventional models are tied to the idea that there is a sort of deep answer lurking inside my mind about how much I value culture, and the same for you and same for everybody else, and we can add up all those values and get an overall value of culture, as it were, to the society. I think that is a real worry, because we know that when we're looking at the value of even more prosaic things, like how much the value is of a particular pleasure like drinking a cup of coffee, or a particular pain like getting a small electric shock, it turns out that the valuations we give for those things are incredibly unstable. And the more general picture that comes out of my reading, at least, of modern cognitive and social psychology is that we are, it's not really driven around by internal values. It's rather that our behaviours are determined by much more superficial things, such as doing things that we can justify, doing things we've done before, doing things other people have done. And from those, we're able to create rationalizations about values we must hold. So it's more that the behavior comes first and the valuation sort of trails along behind. So if I find people taking a particular risk, say, you know, walking across the rail of a bridge or something like this, then I might think, well, everyone else is doing that, I'll do that too. And if you then ask me how risky was it, I'll think, well, I can't have been very risky, I just did it. And that'd be stupid to say it was risky. So the sense of the valuation, or indeed the valuation of your own life, might also be diminished by that. You might start to say things like, it wouldn't be such a disaster if I did die, and you only live once, and you've got to take a risk now and again. So the general point is that people's behaviour often runs ahead of the values that they espouse, and the values come later. Now, it's not to say that our explicit thinking about value is very, very important. It is very important. And of course, in the context of culture particularly, we spend a great deal of time talking to each other about what aspects of culture we value and which ones we don't. So people spend ages talking about music they like or dislike and why. They spend ages talking about things they do or don't like on television and so on and so on. Now, why do they do that? They do that because it's not transparent. If culture was something that the value of which we could measure in a trivial way, it would be no more interesting to have a discussion about music or literature or film than to say, ask the question, I don't know, how tall is this building? And I'd say, well, I think it's about 50 feet, and you'd say, I think it's about 55, and then somebody would measure it, and they'd say, oh, actually, it's 63, and that's just a boring discussion. Now, the thing is that my evaluation is not like something that I can just read off or measure. It's something that I'm constructing and creating in the moment. And one of the reasons I'm interested in doing it and why it's interesting to have discussions about these things is because we're figuring out what we like and what we don't like, and we're defining our own values and behaviour at the time. So it's not a kind of process of peering into one's mental depths. When people are having cultural discussions, they're to some extent defining the kind of people that they actually are.
And as a final question, how might behavioural science allow us to model more efficiently not only the methodologies of cultural value judgment, but moreover the ways in which people value or interact with culture directly?
Well, there's obviously a very wide and deep question. I'm just going to focus on one tiny aspect of it, which is the power of tangibility. So one thing we know about psychology of choices is that when people are trading off between different pluses and minuses when making a choice, the things they pay most attention to tend to be the things they can measure the most. So if you have two different lifestyles, one of which involves more work and more money, but therefore less, say, culture, if we're focusing on culture, but less leisure in general, there's a natural bias towards thinking, leisure, I can't really imagine how much or little stuff I'm going to do in my leisure time, and is 5 hours leisure per evening versus three, is that really very different? I just don't know. But money is very clear. You can very clearly see, that's more than that. And it's not just money, it's just concrete stuff. When you have a choice between something which is good in a concrete way and something else which is good in an intangible, nebulous kind of way, the thing that tends to lose is the intangible thing. And the claim, at least, by many people in the psychology of judgment and decision making, would be that you can see that people make systematic mistakes in this regard, because if they make decisions which push them in the tangible focused direction. And then you ask them afterwards, are they happy with their decision? They often say no. And the people who actually are actually happier with more intangible stuff, they tend to underweight the tangible, intangible. And that's a really great problem for things like likely health outcomes. So you know, your health in the future is a pretty intangible thing. So if you're doing things which are better for your future health, that's probably good, but it's not very clear how good it is. And if there's some immediate, obvious, tangible pleasure like eating a piece of cake, well, that's going to be powerful because it's right there in front of you, and you can see the difference between eating the cake and not. But the effect on your health is very difficult to grasp, and culture potentially suffers that fate. So one reason to be interested in this commission is that we might be a bit wary of trusting the political process, trusting people's natural deliberations to give enough weight to culture, not because culture is especially sort of ethereal and mysterious, just because it's one of those intangible things we haven't got measuring sticks to hold up against. So to the extent that we can give a bit more quantification of cultural value, maybe that will push culture up the agenda in a way that actually we might all prefer, even if we don't tend to act that way.